Welcome to the Inclusion First Podcast, where we amplify the stories of regular people practicing anti-racism in their everyday lives. Every single one of us has the ability to create real and meaningful change right where we are. I'm your host, Carrie Sawyer, and I've got the stories to prove it. I can't wait to introduce you to these people, these change leaders, people who saw a need and decided to take action. To me, this is so inspiring, showing the powerful idea of everyday activism. I hope that you take away at least some small inspiration and use it to act and create more good in your world too. Let's get started, y'all. Hello, hello, and welcome to the Inclusion First Podcast. My name is Carrie Sawyer, and I am your host. Today, we're going to have a really fun conversation with my friend, Aido. Aido and I, actually, we went to grad school both at University of Michigan, but our paths didn't cross until later on in corporate America, where we worked together at both Intel and at Qualcomm. And just as one of the few Black people of a certain position in corporate America, became fast friends. And so I'm excited to reconnect with Aido to hear about some of his really incredible family stories and his approach to anti-racism when it comes to living his own life and then being a light and inspiration for the children that he has as well. So let me introduce you to Aido. Aido Osei is SVP of Product Strategy at Global Payments Incorporated. He is based in the Metro Atlanta area and is a proud dad of three amazing kids. He's also a board member of a local nonprofit called Caring for Others Incorporated. Aido really is good people. He is just a super solid human, and we're going to have a really great conversation. So please join me in welcoming my friend Aido to the Inclusion First Podcast. Hello, hello, and welcome to the Inclusion First Podcast. This is your host, Carrie Sawyer, and I am here with an amazing person, my friend Aido. We met several years ago back at Qualcomm, and I'm super excited to have this conversation. How are you doing, Aido? How is it out there in ATL?
Oh, it's doing great. This is a great time of year. We've got pounds of pollen that are on the cars out here, so you have allergies. This is a great time to be away from Atlanta.
Yeah, for sure. Aido, tell everyone a little bit about yourself and then we'll hop right into the questions.
Yeah, so my name's Aido. A lot of my friends call me AO, originally from right outside of Detroit. So what up, doe? Went to school at Eastern Michigan University, University of Michigan grad, NYU grad, and have just done a lot of really cool things in technology. I've lived in a lot of places. We met in San Diego. I've spent some time in New York, so I've moved around a bit. Right now, I'm a senior vice president of product strategy for Global Payments. And, you know, Global Payments is just an awesome company in the fintech space. We're headquartered in Atlanta. We have about 24,000 employees. It's just a great place to call home from a corporate perspective. So it's good to be here with you, Carrie. It's good to see you again.
It's great to see you too, Aido. I'm super excited for that title, Senior Vice President. That makes me really happy.
It's been great. I've been at Global for 5 years. And prior to that, we worked together at Qualcomm and did a stint at Intel as well. So, you know, I really like to be on kind of the technology end of things.
Yeah.
And more of a product guy, you know, in terms of the corporate thing.
Yeah, that's amazing. All right. So let's get to this first question. I want to talk to you specifically about anti-racism. And the question that I have is like, how do you like define anti-racism, whether for yourself or for other people? Like, what does that mean to you? What does that look like in your life?
Yeah, I mean, I think my approach to being an anti-racist is really just being conscious of the various forms that racism can manifest itself. Mm. Right. So I think it all starts with consciousness and being aware and being educated. Right. And just being a Black man in America, obviously, I have my experiences. Everybody has their experiences. I feel blessed to call a lot of different types of people my friends, and I embrace a lot of different cultures, and I like to travel. So my perspective around racism, I try to be global in my perspective and not just kind of speak from an American-centric perspective, even though that's my experience. But I define it as just really being an advocate for justice and being an advocate for fairness and access. And obviously, you know, white supremacy is institutionally embedded in so much of kind of the, you know, the culture and so much of the, you know, the fabric of our reality today. So it's really hard to kind of point out, like, this is white supremacy and this is white supremacy. You know, these are micro inequity, you know, inequities that get manifested in different daily interactions. So I'm not constantly on the lookout for those things. And I'm not constantly a person who's going to be pointing those things out and trying to educate people who are not, you know, vested in actually caring about those things.
Sure.
Where my focus has been is really trying to think about what are the building blocks of community, right? And what are the things that are going to help communities be stronger? And if that means advocating for a particular policy or participating and volunteering my time to a particular nonprofit, that's where I'm going to invest my focus. And then, of course, my number one priority is my children, and really trying to make sure that they are capable of navigating as healthy, whole individuals, that they don't feel limited, and that they, you know, feel like they have a voice where they can express themselves and not have somebody else's version of them be kind of limiting or imposing restrictions on them. So that's a long-winded answer, but, you know, that's kind of how I process the concept of anti-racism. As an African-American studies major, undergrad, clearly, you know, I, like many people, kind of have come up from an Afrocentric aesthetic, you know, in terms of my scholarship and in terms of what I read. But I also realize that there are a lot of other perspectives as well. So, you know, I really just try to focus from the perspective of respect, right? I want to be respected for who I am. I want my children to be respected for who they are. I want policies to reflect fairness and justice, and I want communities that have been historically disadvantaged to, you know, to be to prosper. You know, I want things that are making people suffer, I want those things to be stopped, you know. So wherever I can lend a voice or a hand to in moving in that direction, that's kind of what I do.
I love it. And I love how multifaceted that it is. And I also love that you're, you know, super honest. We're human. We're focusing on all different things at all different times. And it's not like, you know, every single day, every single thing, you're like on the lookout, on the hunt. Because there's a lot, and you would, I don't even know if you could live like that, honestly. But as it comes to you, as you see opportunities, both at home, in the community, at work, you know, really just getting in where you fit in and taking those steps and inserting yourself where those opportunities are. I think that's a great way to approach anti-racism, because it isn't about going and getting a new hobby or a new set of friends or a new this or that. It really is about making the difference where you are. And it sounds like obviously you're super inserted in this work just through who you are, how you've grown up, you know, your background and your family and everything like that. So awesome. I thought it was a great answer. Not long-winded at all. Just perfect. You talked about your kids. So you have two teenagers, which is incredible. And a boy and a girl also. And I'm super interested. We get a lot of questions around how do you talk to your kids about racism? And I would love to hear, like, how did you talk to your kids? Obviously, if you have teenagers, they had to talk a long time ago. But when everything blew up in 2020 around the murder of George Floyd and the aftermath of that, what was the conversation like with your 14-year-old son and, well, maybe 13-year-old son at the time, or wait, I can't do math. Anyways, your son who's a teenager and your tween and your daughter who would have been, you know, a new teenager at that time. What was that conversation like with them?
Well, the good thing is we watch a lot of movies together. We watch a lot of TV shows. Mm-hmm. We listen to a lot of music together. And if I really want to give them a sense of connection to the arts, because the arts, I think, provide a good motif by which we can talk about a lot of different things, whether it's political, emotional, what have you. So when we went to go see the movie, oh man, what's the name of it? With the young lady who, it was a movie about police brutality. Mm-hmm. And the young lady was from California, and she, you know, she had...
Was it The Hate U Give?
Thank you.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, so we went to go see that movie, and that gave us an opportunity to kind of talk about police brutality, to talk about racism, to talk about the different worlds that we live in and how we navigate those worlds and how we decide who we are going to be and how we give a voice to things when they're, you know, when injustice happens. You know, are we going to be silent? Are we going to speak out? Are we going to protest? Are we going to allow others to define our humanity and which lives are worth more than others? So those are conversations that we have, and we talk about it. And even in the music, even if it's in hip hop, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we'll talk about like the value of life, and we'll talk about the value of, you know, how we treat females, how we treat males, you know, how we treat our brothers when we see them. And as my son grows up and he's getting more muscles now, he's growing taller. He's no longer just the cute black boy. Now he's like a strong young man. He's realizing that people are looking at him differently.
Sure.
You know, this gentleman staring at me, Dad, I don't really know what that's about. This is new for me. Like, what's going on? So we have conversations about perceptions and bias. And, you know, my daughter particularly is, she looks at injustice that's happening all over the world, you know, and she seems to be incensed whenever something unjust is happening. And George Floyd was just another example for her of, you know, someone basically in a power position oppressing, you know, people who are in some ways powerless. And that is, you know, that's something that I'm glad that she's incensed by. And I don't want them to be desensitized to with everything that they consume on social media and on the news. So it's been an ongoing conversation. And as they get more mature, we deal with more mature topics, and we get into a little bit more nuance as to the way these things end up playing out. And it's not always the big events that are the most impactful as it relates to racism and as it relates to bias and discrimination. But where I'm really trying to get them is to try and understand what are some of the preconditions that happen. What has happened 30 years ago? What has happened 100 years ago that has led us to the point where we see the conditions that exist today? Mm-hmm. And that's a lifelong journey. I mean, all of us need to continue to understand those things and how the past informs the future. So, you know, I learn as much from them as they learn from me.
I bet they have great questions. You're like, I have no idea how to answer that. Let's just talk it through.
And one of the things that I have done with my children, more so with my daughter, we live in separate houses. So I'm kind of a single dad at this point in life. Mm-hmm. And so I do write letters. And one of the things during the pandemic that I did with my daughters, I wrote letters. And in those letters, I almost formatted them like a newsletter, because I put not only things that were going on with me and going on with her, but things that were going on in society. And so I take news clippings or photos of the different things that are going on, and then hyperlink different stories of, you know, why, you know, what's going on in this area of Minnesota or Minneapolis. You know, let's look historically about, you know, redlining. You know, let's really understand how certain communities have become disenfranchised. So, you know, I would put those in the letter so that she would have them to look at later. Mm-hmm. And I think that those conversations hopefully, you know, extend for years into the future that maybe she could have with her kids.
Sure.
At some point.
Yeah. I think that's fantastic as an approach, because you're not just sitting down like, okay, kids, you know, trying to come up with like a framework to explain things. You're using things, the interests that you share, you're using movies, you're using music, you're using the news, you're using these topics just as a natural and super organic landscape for having these really authentic and important conversations. And so, you know, as parents are like, how do I breach the subject, especially white ally parents? And I get, that's where we get most of our questions around talking about race, specifically with their kids. Like, you don't have to just come at it like a, you know, like the sex talk out of the blue. It can be something that's couched and anchored in what's already going on and the things that you already talk about and the things that you already share. I thought that's really powerful tip that people can take home with them. I would love to, so you talked about how it's not always the big things that have the most kind of meaningful conversations result out of it. And when it comes to racism and how we're navigating the world, what can you give an example of like a smaller, like maybe more local or even just personal situation that you had with your kids that really like you got something really meaningful out of that, a really meaningful topic or conversation resulted from that?
Well, I think this can be a segue topic, but when my dad passed away a couple of years ago, I always like to share with them stories he told me.
Mm.
Right. And I remember taking my son to Purdue University. My dad graduated 1962, class of mechanical engineering at Purdue University. Very proud of that fact. It's something he talked about a lot. And he would always talk about what that experience was like for him, because, mm-hmm. you know, when you look at that class photo, there's one black person in that photo. It's one African-American person. And he talked about the sense of isolation that he felt
sure.
on that campus. And he also talked about the drive that he had to not let that stop him. So when we set up a scholarship in my dad's name, the Odell Johnson Scholarship at Purdue, it was good to have my son on that campus and interacting with the students at the Minority Engineering Program office there. Great program. And he kind of got a chance to see how things are now where there's critical mass, and juxtapose that to the stories of how things were, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Right.
And so that's just a subtle example of progress and how our foremothers did not let disadvantage or bias or obstacles stop them from achieving. Now, of course, that's one example. It's almost a success story. There are stories that don't end so nicely, but in terms of motivation, I like to talk about, and, you know, I actually told this to the students at Purdue, you know, if my dad can achieve some of these things in 1962, then,
right,
you know, we don't really have a whole lot of excuses now for why we can't achieve, you know. So, you know, I try and look for ways to empower my kids in different situations, even though there might be a teacher that looks at them funny, or there might be, you know, somebody in the store that behaves in a way that they didn't appreciate. You know, I always try and find ways for them to shake that off and, you know, just brush that off their mm-hmm. shoulder.
Yeah. And that sounds like a lesson that you probably learned from your family and from your dad. And this conversation is really happening because Aido shared this incredible story about really anti-racism and activism that his dad started and when he was working. And I'd love to jump right into that. Thank you for the segue. I love to jump right into more on that story, and really, like, you have this super strong and powerful background of activism in your family, probably starting before your dad, but your dad was, I mean, it was incredible what he did. So I'd love to jump right in there and share with everyone.
Sure, absolutely. In fact, if my dad heard somebody refer to him as an activist, he'd probably like spit out his beer or whatever. The term activist obviously is a broad term, but in many ways, as a Black engineer, you know, early, you know, 70s, late 60s, early 70s, He was quite active at General Motors. And, you know, I did a little story, if you will, that's available. Maybe you can share it with some of your listeners.
Definitely.
It just kind of gives a synopsis of this story. But he, along with a really good friend named Charlie Beckham, who's a well-known politician, retired politician in Detroit, started a what would end up being kind of a tradition for Black engineers at General Motors. It was called the GM Soul Picnic. And it was a play on Soul Train, which kind of started around the same time. Mm-hmm. But the story, as Charlie tells it to me, is that they went to the General Motors Men's Club Picnic, and it was called the Men's Club Picnic at that time. And they just had an awful time. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were probably the only ones there that were African-American. They weren't really made to feel kind of welcome. They were kind of looked at as outsiders.
Why are you here?
Why are you here? It was just kind of, it wasn't an inclusive event for them. And they just kind of came back and said, this was awful. You know, we need to create a gathering where all of the Black folks at General Motors could get together and we could bring our families and our kids. And it could be, you know, just kind of a place where we can relax and be us.
Mm-hmm.
And so they started planning that in kind of 1971, 1972 timeframe. And they really took their time to do it. They spent a year pulling this together. And the first one was small, but, you know, it lasted for about 15 years.
Wow.
And after a couple of years, there were literally hundreds of African-American employees of General Motors in that Detroit, Metro Detroit area. People would actually drive up from Ohio and Indiana and anywhere in the Midwest, they would drive up for this picnic. And I viewed it as almost, it was a platform. It was a cultural platform
mm-hmm.
where me as a kid going to this, I mean, it was like the best of, you know, Black America, you know.
Right.
It really didn't matter what your level was. It didn't matter if you were a secretary or whether you were a design engineer. It wasn't really about that. It was about the fact that, you know, we all work at General Motors and, you know, we're going to create this event to network, to, you know, to build relationships, to build mentoring, and to just have our families come out and experience all of this Black excellence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was a vibe, you know. We had WJLB radio playing,
awesome.
Dance competitions, you know, the smell of Kool-Aid and barbecued ribs and, you know, just everything that makes us us. And at the same time, we had just had these brilliant men and women that were there putting on this community event. And, you know, I just, when I think back of all the different things that he did, this is one that stands out because I think it's transformative in that it pushes the culture forward and it makes corporate America change to think about itself differently, right? You know, there was a funny story that Charlie told where my dad, OJ, they called him OJ, and he got called down to the HR office at corporate when they found out what they were doing. You know, this is a few years after the Detroit riots. I mean, because we're talking 1972. The riots were like in 68. You know, tensions were high. And they got called down after, you know, planning this picnic. And they were sitting down at the head of HR. And they said, "We heard y'all have been planning something. What are y'all up to?" They were like thinking they were going to get fired.
No, you can't gather.
They said, "Hey, look, we're just trying to plan a picnic for Black folks at General Motors." And the feedback was, "Well, we already have a picnic." And they said, "Well, we've been to that picnic." That picnic wasn't very good for us. We didn't have a good time. So they were, you know, GM was great about it. They offered support and Charlie and OJ kind of said, we'll plan it ourselves, but, you know, just allow us to have this and know that it's happening. It's something we think is going to be good for morale. And we think it's going to be good as a recruitment tool. We think it's going to be good for, you know, just overall work-life balance for our new employees. So it went on for many, many years and it grew to actually thousands of people. And I think it was just one of the earliest examples for me of how you transform a space, how you take action and not just complain, but how you, you know, bring about an environment where people can feel included and empowered to be their best at work, right? And to bring them their whole selves to work, right? And so that's just one example. I like to memorialize that for my children and their children as something that they can do today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to underscore like the timing of this. Like, this is not a time where it was like not a huge feat and a dangerous feat, both like literally, physically, politically, like professionally, personally. It was dangerous to do something like this at that time and to kind of step out and see a larger vision and see a possibility for coming together and creating good where maybe there was a gap or where people were being excluded before. And so it wasn't just as easy as, hey guys, you want to start a picnic? There was real, there was a lot of risk involved in taking this step. And that's why I was like, your dad was an activist.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I mean, the timing is everything there because this is really a special era. I mean, you've got Black Enterprise that was founded that same year. Soul Train, as I mentioned, had just been, just come on the air. General Motors at that time was, I think, the top company in the Fortune 500, you know, just in terms of overall market cap. So if you're going to do that at any company at any time, you know, Detroit was the place and General Motors was the city. And that was, you know, one small act of resistance, even though it was a fun example. But, you know, fun examples can also be transformative.
For sure.
As well, you know, from a cultural perspective. So, you know, I kind of take that forward and think about ways in which, you know, we can continue to push the envelope today. You know, we're in a different environment. Everything's different from 50 years ago, but some things aren't different.
Right? No, but, for sure.
But yeah, you know, I just kind of really enjoy you. I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity to tell that story.
No, it's our pleasure. And I'm glad that people are able to hear it as well, because it's super powerful. And here at the Inclusion First Project and in the Inclusion First Institute, we talk about, you know, when you are stepping into your role of activism, regardless of whether we think about it as a spectrum, right? Like we've got our MLK, our Rosa Parks, our Malcolm X is on one side, and then, you know, everyone on down the line to like the smallest act. So when you're thinking about your place on that spectrum, like I believe there's no act big, too big or too small. Honestly, because we never know what ripple that's going to create out in the world, whether it's for an individual or a ton of people as well. And people are always watching you, no matter what. They're watching the good you do, they're watching the bad you do, they're watching the neutral that you do. And so being able to be a model, your dad and Charlie, to people internally, like, hey, you know what, we're going to stand up and we're going to do this. And because GM was in the position that it was in at the time, GM then being a larger model of, hey, you know what, well, GM's doing this over here in Illinois, over here in, you know, California, over here in New York. Well, they're doing it. So maybe we can think about we might do it too. Like nothing bad happened for them. And this is, you know, thinking from more of the like corporate managerial white standpoint, like, well, they did it. So all right, well, let's consider this, right? And so the ripples that were created by what your dad and Charlie did are like, I mean, we'll never know the full extent, but no doubt that they were super powerful and were able to influence far beyond the walls of you know, the GM offices where everything originally started.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, just coming from that area, it's just great to think about like the early days of Nesby and, you know, any professional organization that is trying to break down walls or barriers and create, you know, a common family atmosphere where, you know, at the end of the day, people need encouragement, right? And that encouragement can come in a lot of forms, right? And then secondly, they need access to opportunities, right? So when those two things come together, I think great things can happen. I think the other example that I'll just throw out there, where I just have had the benefit of seeing someone who I really admire just kind of grow their platform is Calvin Mackey and what he's doing with STEMNOLA. So Calvin, I consider him to be a friend. I've known him for, 20 plus years, met him while I was at the University of Michigan, and did a lot of projects with him early in his career to just promote his brand of STEM education and advocacy for disadvantaged children. Now, his platform is bigger than that, but we know that it started with trying to really communicate to students of color that, science, technology, the arts, all of these things are really important to make sure we're, providing to our kids, because that's going to give them the best possible landscape for future success, in terms of work and in terms of prosperity. So, just being associated with him and seeing what he's been able to do over the last 10, 15 years and his consistency has been motivational. And so I take that and, his speeches, and I also share that with my children, and just make sure that they can see and hear from the stories of so many people like that.
Yeah.
Who have come from, unexpected places and are doing amazing things with their voice and with their talent.
Yeah. The idea of, you can see it. If you can see it, you can be it. We hear that thrown around. You're like, yeah. But it's so true. I can't think of the different, there's so many examples of times where I saw something that someone was doing and I related to them in some way, whether it was because they were a woman, because they were in, design, because they were a person of color that I had never considered possible before. And I'm like, well, if they did that, I don't have to do that same thing. But if they did that, if they made that up, I could find something like that. I could find my thing too, right? Where I could do something similar. And so being able to see that and really embody that as a possibility versus, I can only do X, Y, Z. And I was very blessed and fortunate to grow up in a home where my mom told me from a very young age that I could do anything that I put my mind to. And at a certain point, I started to actually believe her, hence the trajectory of my life. My career has not been traditional at all, but I believed her. And I saw examples of that, throughout my life. And I was on the lookout, look, that person is doing something that they're putting their mind to that is outside of the norm. Even if it's just a small step to the side, there's so many examples of that. And it's really powerful and really important for not just our young people, but even us as adults to have those examples and that remember that no matter what's happening in our lives right now, no matter how great or not great it's going, we always have the power to change it and choose something different. And I believe that we can create whatever we want and that our lives typically, not even typically, always are this really interesting, just path that sets us up perfectly for that thing when we're ready to kind of step into it. I mean, it never makes sense going through it, but afterwards you're like, oh yeah, I see all these completely disparate things that I never would have connected made me the perfect person to do this right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I love what you said. And, I just feel like it comes from the, combining the head and the heart.
Mm-hmm.
And if your heart is in the right place, another thing that I'm involved with, Carrie, is I've been a supporter of a local nonprofit called Caring for Others here in the greater Atlanta area. And the founder of that organization, her name is Esleen Shockley. And she's just, she comes from kind of a disadvantaged background. She says, hey, I was dirt poor. I didn't have shoes to wear to school.
Wow.
From Guyana. And she came to America and just had a great corporate career, was forced into retirement early, and just decided that because of a health challenge, she said, hey, I'm going to spend the rest of my life, no matter how long that is, in trying to make a difference in the lives of other people. And hence the name of the organization, Caring for Others.
Mm-hmm.
The thing I like about the platform that she's built, just an amazing social innovator. Social entrepreneurship to the hilt in just her creativity and the scale in which she's developed her organization. But the thing that's most important is she really appeals and talks to the heart, right? Whether it's the people that she's giving food or clothing or whatever goods it is and services that she's delivering, whether it's to those people who, for her, it's about dignity and respect. hey, when I'm giving something to someone in need, I want to give it in a way that recognizes them as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I'm not throwing, you know, toilet paper across the room to somebody.
Sure.
I'm giving them new things, and I want to restore their dignity as human beings. Right. So it's that aspect. But then on for people who have resources or talents that they should be giving and investing, but they're not. So she has a really good way of talking to their heart and talking to them about the reason why we should not be selfish with, and it doesn't even have to be our money or our things. Don't be selfish with your talent.
Right.
Look for opportunities to help other people. And for us in our community, that should be primal, right? Like we should really seek to do that first for our own communities, which have been so disadvantaged, have been so downtrodden with so many different layers of political and economic hardship. But it's also a human story, right? If there's a disaster, whether it's a tornado or, you know, some kind of natural disaster and people are in need, you know, as human beings, we should help one another, irrespective of where we come
from.
You know what I mean? So it's that humanity that I think is really at this stage in my life that's really most important, and really looking for opportunities to have an impact on the lives of people, you know, who are just looking for help.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think your point about the continuum is really right for me, because it can be a small act and it doesn't have to be a lot of hoopla around it. And it doesn't have to involve social media.
Right.
It doesn't have to involve a bullhorn or a protest to be huge in what you do. In fact, some of the things that you do when people aren't looking and you're not promoting it are the most impactful. You know, it could be a word of encouragement. It could be, you know, some minor donation that you make to a person in need. You know, so, you know, when I think about anti-racism, I think those small acts of defiance are revolutionary if done at scale.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So,
yeah,
you know, with what Sister Stacey Abrams is doing here and trying to have a fair and just electoral process and enforce the importance of, you know, actually living up to the ideals of, you know, democracy as documented in our Constitution. And, you know, I just think that we are living in precarious times on the political front.
We are, very much so.
There's a real tendency for people to go to different corners, you know, and just fight it out on social media. So, you know, I just have a huge amount of respect and have a desire to support those that have the talent to be above the fray and to really try and speak to our better angels, as they say, so that we may maintain our humanity, our compassion, our desire to understand and be understood. And, you know, that we will not oversimplify the challenges that we face with racism and white supremacy. Because white supremacy is not just a problem for Black people and Hispanic people and people of color, it's a problem for white people, you know? So, you know, I think where you have well-meaning advocates, it's important that they feel included and not be, you know, marginalized themselves, you know, we have a lot of people who have good hearts who want to do the right thing or trying to understand how to do that. And then, you know, we also have to make sure that we don't focus so much on the past and on the things that are wrong that we don't take advantage of the things that are right and the opportunities that are right in front of us as well. So, you know, this is not easy stuff to discuss and talk about because it's emotion laden and et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, I really appreciate those that are out actually doing things. And, you know, I want to dedicate my time and my dollars to supporting them as much as possible.
Yeah, exactly.
So even the work that you're doing, Carrie, I think is important. So, you know, I appreciate you for taking your talent and creating this platform to, you know, invite people like me to, you know, to share thoughts with you and, you know, to kind of be part of the discussion and guide it in a certain positive direction.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Aido. And I appreciate you being on the podcast today. I have one more question for you and then we'll wrap up. I think you've dropped some really good gems for everyone. And, you know, I love the idea of just recognizing the humanity in all of us, and that humanity is not the same. We're all humans, yes, but we're also different. And so it's not about being colorblind or not seeing our differences, but recognizing that we are all human and that we all have a slew of basic needs and then other things, needs and wants and desires that make us uniquely unique, and that those things are special too. And that all of these things can live alongside each other versus being in competition with each other, even when it feels like that's not true. Right. And so how do you seek that out? How do you know that it's always there and look for it and look to highlight it and spotlight it and raise that up as we're, you know, as we're moving and navigating through the world? I think that's really the challenge of many things, but definitely a cornerstone of what it means to be an activist, to be anti-racist, and to look for these different opportunities to connect. And that takes us right back to your original point around, you know, building community and looking for ways to foster and to expand and broaden and support community overall.
Well, that was very well said. I don't have anything to add to that, Carrie. You know, I really think it's important that we don't be complacent. And that's where I end. You know, it is so easy with the pandemic and with all the things that are going on with us emotionally, you know, our mental health,
right,
being attacked all the time, you know, so, you know, being able to be in a place where you're mentally and emotionally, you know, secure and healthy is so important. And building upon that, you know, I think it's also important that we look for opportunities to not be complacent or reactive. You know, so I think those are two things that, you know, I just kind of continue to meditate on and look for opportunities. Now, what are the ways in which, you know, I or my friends or, you know, my little tribe can do more and be more effective and scale more?
Absolutely. Aido, this was amazing. Thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for all your thoughts and insights. If people want to follow you or find more about, you know, the causes that you're supporting or the work that you're doing out there in the world to, you know, make the impact that you can make, where can they find you? What's the best way to connect with you?
Well, on Twitter, I am at Redemption Zone. So I love being on Twitter, and, you know, anyone who wants to connect with me there, you know, please follow me and I'll follow you back.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Aido.
All right. Take care. Thanks, Carrie.
Thank you for listening to the Inclusion First podcast. We are always collecting and answering your most important questions on anti-racism. So if there's something on your mind, head on over to the inclusionfirstproject.org and click on Ask a Question. We'd love for you to give us your like, your share, your follow, and especially your review, wherever you find us. Thank you so much again for listening, and we will talk to you next time.